Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week in the news, U.S. diplomatic secrets spill all over, big talk on deficit fighting, and unemployment benefits run out for millions as unemployment rises. WikiLeaks put hundreds of thousands of secret diplomatic cables into public view. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, not happy.
There is nothing brave about sabotaging the peaceful relations between nations on which our common security depends.
No mandate emerging from the president's bipartisan deficit commission, but former GOP senator and commission co-chair Alan Simpson said the U.S. must act.
No more fun and games, smoke and mirrors, alchemy, trickery, cunning, CYA, demagoguery, and making promises we can't possibly keep.
And no extension of unemployment benefits as they run out for millions of Americans. Jobless rate up to 9.8%. Here's Angel Garland, unemployed for almost a year.
Well, I'm raising my son, single mom. I'm thinking to myself, what will I do? You know, where will I go?
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines with CNN foreign affairs correspondent Jill Doherty, Time Magazine congressional correspondent J. Newton Small, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What is unfolding here on tax cuts, debt, WikiLeaks, jobs? Can you feel the power shift in Washington? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Jill, Jay, Jack, it's great to have all of you with us. And Jill, we've got a lot to hear on the WikiLeaks global front. We're so glad you're here. But Jay, bring us home first to, I guess, maybe taxes, first of all. What is going on with this big back and forth? Republicans, Democrats, you know, who's going to be taxed? Whose tax cuts will be extended, Jay?
Hi, Tom. This week has been really interesting on the tax front. They started off, you know, with this Slurpee summit at the White House with Republican leaders finally meeting with President Obama, as well as Democratic leaders. And they sort of had this somewhat of a orchestrated kumbaya moment where they all sort of held hands and said, we're going to work together. It's going to be great. And then the next day, literally, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell put out a letter signed by all 42 Republicans in the Senate, which now there are 42 since Mark Kirk was sworn in from Illinois, and saying that we're not going to do anything. We refuse to do anything at all in the Senate until you figure out a solution on taxes and on funding the government. So, you know, it was a very partisan move that really sort of blindsided the Democrats in the Senate, who had just the day before filed to, you know, work on an immigration bill, and that's now been shelved. And so now they're forced to come to an agreement, and the rest of the agenda is held hostage to it. Whether, you know, there's a lot of conventional wisdom in Washington. The simple agreement would be to renew the sort of tax cuts for those making $250,000 and less for the first $250,000 permanently, and then do a temporary solution, a temporary fix for the upper income brackets. But, you know, there's a lot of Republicans who feel that they should not be decoupled. John Kyle in the Senate is one of those who's really blocking this. And so even as some Republicans have said that this might be a solution that works for them, there are others who are digging in their heels, and they're just simply in talks now trying to come to a resolution.
Now, Jay, we're reading today the Washington Post, New York Times, and elsewhere saying that there's a lot of dickering going on between the White House, congressional Republicans over whether some compromise here, where tax cuts for the rich, those are extended, they go forward, but the White House gets extension of unemployment benefits for those that would be running out otherwise, and maybe a new round of stimulus money in the bargain as well. What do you know about that, Jay?
Well, certainly, I think there's, you know, the White House is feeling the pressure, and you know they know that right now the economy, the job situation with today we reported there are 36,000 jobs that were added to the economy, but unemployment went up from 9.6% to 9.8%. That's getting dangerously close to 10%. And the person that they're going to blame is not John Boehner or Mitch McConnell. It's Barack Obama. And you know, the president's up for re-election or probably going to run for re-election in the next 2 years. And they definitely are feeling the pressure to do something. But the problem is that they just don't have anything that they can do with Republicans in Congress right now. And there is a lot of bickering going back and forth. There's a lot of, you know, so much that, you know, the Slurpee Summit, they said they're going to work well together and this is a promising beginning, and things just aren't going that well. They can hardly even agree on where to meet and what time to meet, let alone what to say during those meetings. And it's a problem because the Republicans just don't want to give him an inch, anything that he can claim as a win.
Republicans saying, you're not acknowledging who won the midterm elections. We did. And drawing that line in the sand, here's a little bit of Democratic perspective on what's going on. This is Democratic Representative Chris Van Hollen of Maryland talking about the Democrats' position on tax cut extensions.
The Democrats have a very clear position on this. We want to make sure that we expand tax cuts for the middle class. And I should also point out that every single American gets a tax break from that. In fact, under that plan, if you're over $250,000, you still benefit from all the tax relief up to $250,000. So every American gets tax relief. It's just they don't get this bonus $100,000 per average for millionaires tax cut.
But the House Speaker in waiting, John Boehner, was having none of it, saying, we're going to take over and things are going to be different.
If the lame duck Congress is unable or unwilling to cut spending and stop all the coming tax hikes, the new majority in January will. That's what we said in the Pledge to America. We meant it when we said it, and that's what we will do. Listen, this tax hike only validates the American people's repudiation of Washington and the politicians who refuse to listen to the American people.
Jill Doherty is with us, CNN's foreign affairs correspondent. Jill, Europe has been all tied up over debt this week. I mean, how are people, from what you can see abroad, looking at the American debate over taxes, over deficit? Big conversation around deficit this week. Is the United States seen as getting on track, having more time than Europe? What are you hearing, Jill?
Well, one of the problems is that the rest of the world, and Europe in particular, looks at the United States as the problem, that the United States is not doing what it should do in tightening its belt. And I think the most interesting thing is what's happening in Great Britain, where you do have an example of what can happen when a government decides to take draconian action. So there could be a lesson for the Americans there. But, you know, it goes back to, of course, the worldwide economic crisis and the perception that it really started with the United States, although obviously everybody is involved.
Jack, here we are on a day when people were hoping and even expecting pretty good job numbers. And in fact, it's just the opposite. The job hike of very modest, way below expectations, and unemployment rate in this country now up to 9.8%. This is not what anybody was hoping for, Jack.
No, these are parlous numbers indeed. And, it comes at a moment when, on the one hand, the Republicans are saying we need to extend tax cuts to people, essentially to millionaires, $700 billion over a decade. And on the other hand, you got the Deficit Commission saying we need to make $4 trillion in cuts. Well, you know, if all the Bush tax cuts are enacted, that's $4 trillion. If the Deficit Commission recommendations, if those are enacted, that's $4 trillion. So if you kept the Bush tax cuts and did everything the Deficit Commission wanted, you'd be right where we are today. And I'm struck when I'm with the irrealism, really, of most of what the Deficit Commission is talking about when you connect it to today's jobs report. There's nothing in that proposal, well, except for something that Dick Durbin insisted on, that would stimulate the economy, that would get this unemployment rate down or even plausibly get it down. Durbin insisted that there be a payroll tax holiday of some period, some months at least in next year, and that the cuts, that the most serious cuts, be put off till 2013. That would at least help somewhat. But the idea that somehow Britain would be a model for us, I mean, if we were to do the British model today, we could have unemployment at 12, 13, 14%.
And of course, this extension of unemployment benefits, and they're running out for the 2 million plus in this month, going nowhere so far. Some dickering going on that front. But Republicans tying that into the deficit picture and saying, no, we won't extend unemployment benefits because it's going to add to the national credit card debt, said Republican Senator from Massachusetts, Scott Brown.
So make no mistake, I agree that they need help. But I look at it, are we going to do it from the bank account or are we going to put it on the credit card? Bank account, credit card. How about you folks up there? Bank account, credit card. Okay? I know what I want to do. I'll use the bank account.
The bank account. But what is the bank account? Jay, can you see a scenario in which before, you know, this really rubber really hits the road on ending these unemployment benefits around right around the holidays, the Republicans come on board? Or are there internal politics of the GOP now in Congress just no how, no way?
Well, certainly, this is a debate that's happened many times. And if you'll remember, Jim Bunning, a senator from Kentucky over the summer, let them lapse because he essentially filibustered them. Then it happened again with Tom Coburn in the fall. So this is really the third time that they've lapsed and then had to be reinstated. But also the longest amount of unemployment benefits that in the nation's history, 99 weekers or people who've been on unemployment benefits for 99 weeks and have fallen off. But extending them again, it would be almost, I think, unprecedented. At the same time, this isn't an easy choice for a lot of senators, particularly senators in states with the economy where the economy is suffering. For example, Olympia Snowe in Maine has a bill out that would fully offset the unemployment benefits using stimulus funds, leftover stimulus money. And, you know, Maine is suffering. Like, I saw an astonishing study the other day where it said that a quarter of a million Mainers were going hungry, that, you know, didn't know where they were going to find their next meal. And that's a tough situation for Olympia Snowe to be looking at going into a re-election in 2012. Where she's most likely going to get challenged by a Tea Party candidate. And so she's trying to do something to really help her state, but it's very difficult when the rest of her conference is really unwilling to pass these things again. And I just don't see a way where, especially given the atmosphere, the Tea Party wins, that they're going to pass this unemployment insurance benefits without either using stimulus money or TARP money. And that's just something that Democrats absolutely oppose. They say that money is intended for stimulating the economy, for helping the economy, and you're sort of robbing the rich or robbing the poor to help the poor. It's just it doesn't make any sense.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, WikiLeaks revelations, debt, taxes, unemployment benefits running out, and new numbers not so great on jobs just out today. Jill Doherty is with us, CNN's foreign affairs correspondent. Jay Newton-Small is with us, congressional correspondent for Time magazine. She writes Time's Swampland Politics blog. Jack Beatty's here. Jill, we've got to go to WikiLeaks. I mean, just day after day, this incredible drumbeat, a kind of, undressing of the American Foreign Service, American foreign policy. All these diplomatic cables right out in clear view now. Moves against WikiLeaks to go after their servers. There's a cat and mouse game going on now. High dudgeon out of Washington. On the other hand, I'm reading here John Perry Barlow, sort of a digital libertarian, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, calling on his folks to retweet WikiLeaks, to direct people to them. He says the first serious info war is now engaged. How are you looking at the fallout of this week and WikiLeaks, Jill?
You know, it's huge, Tom, and I don't think that we ultimately know where this is going to end up. Actually, I don't think it's ever going to end up because it's created this enormous wave that just started, remember, last weekend. It's not even a week old. And when you look at in terms of not only how it affects the United States and the revelations about what the United States is doing behind the scenes, but it's really a three-dimensional or, you know, nine-dimensional chess game, because the United States, in its relations with other countries and in these cables, are being revealed the positions of other countries and how they look at other countries. Witness, you know, what China thinks of North Korea, et cetera. And so that there are very, very, I think, long-term implications of this. And when you look at what they're saying on Capitol Hill, you know, let's prosecute him, it qualifies as espionage, it feels kind of late. I mean, yes, maybe eventually you'd be able to find him, Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. But beyond that, there's no pulling this back. It's out there. This stuff is out there, and there's going to be more.
We've got all kinds of response here on Facebook. Tyra says Julian Assange should be in jail. But another, here's a Twitter to On Point Radio. WikiLeaks is necessary. Corporate media abandoned journalism's crucial adversarial stance to government. Assange is taking it up. Here's another Facebook posting from Angie. Says, I wouldn't say Julian Assange is my hero, but oh, sure, I like the man if there's accountability. Get the truth out there, she says. Assange, people aren't sure exactly where he is. Maybe Scotland Yard knows. Sweden bringing back. It's a call for his arrest through Interpol, I guess. But Assange was in an interview with Time magazine, set to be released today, and there was a little sound from it here. He says we should see the resignation of Hillary Clinton.
She should resign if it can be shown that she was responsible for ordering U.S. Diplomatic figures to engage in espionage activities at the United Nations.
A little rugged on the sound there, but of course this is referring to one of the leaked cables, or some of them, in which Secretary of State Hillary Clinton asked U.S. diplomats to gather information on high U.N. officials. Washington this week talking about taking legal action against Assange. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder saying he would go after WikiLeaks to the extent of the law.
It's not saber-rattling. This is, as I said, an active, ongoing investigation. To the extent that we can find anybody who was involved in the breaking of American law and who has put at risk the assets and the people that I have described, they will be held responsible. They will be held accountable.
All kinds of cyber attacks on WikiLeaks already today that have got them moving. The cat and mouse game is on. J. Newton Small, what about on the legal front? Do you hear things really gearing up? I mean, they're talking about going back to laws from the 19-teens in this country to potentially pull out, dust off, and take after Julian Assange.
Well, I think this is a sort of classic Congress, you know, is angry because there's all these headlines and they feel impotent because they can't do anything about it. So they, you know, like the AIG tax back their bonuses, kind of tempest in a teapot. I don't know that it'll last much longer, but, you know, they're going to have hearings. They're going to try and find some way to, as you said, dust off some old laws, maybe do something. But I don't know that there's really much that they can do, frankly. I mean, he's not in the United States. He's not under our jurisdiction, nor are these servers. And so they're going to be hard-pressed to be able to find something that they can do to this man.
But, Jill, if we're in a new era, I mean, you're going to have people who say, you know, he's a champion of accountability. You're going to have others who say this is a tantamount. Hillary Clinton used the word tantamount to an attack on the United States. Now, John Perry Barlow from the other angle says it's info war. I mean, maybe new rules will emerge as well here. Maybe they're emerging right now. If there are cyber attacks underway on WikiLeaks, who knows who's putting those up?
Yeah, actually, there's a lot of question as to who is all behind all of this. In fact, we were just talking about Vladimir Putin in an interview with Larry King on CNN, seemed to be indicating that some in the intelligence community believe that there may be somebody even behind Julian Assange or behind all of this. Who knows? But I think you've got a lot of things. Number one, technically, how did it get out? And that is what they're looking at right now. And the entire government is seized with making sure that they plug any holes so that things like this don't happen again. There's no way they're going to pull this, what's out there, back. Then also, you know, some people have said, well, why doesn't the U.S. government just destroy WikiLeaks, you know, go after them, take aggressive action on the Internet? And some interesting things have come out from that, because the Defense Department and others from the government saying, you know, we're not going to do this, and we chose not to, because using these offensive cyber capabilities would tip the hand to other countries and the enemies of the United States for something larger that might happen, a mm-hmm. real cyber attack that could take down the entire, you know, net for the U.S. government. So, again, we are into unknown territory. And how the government is going to have to communicate will have to change.
Of course, somebody's going after WikiLeaks already just in the last day or two. Let's go to our listeners. Ted in Toronto, Canada. Ted, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Just quick points. First, I did have a chance to meet some American diplomats. They're not known for their tactfulness and discretion to begin with.
Well, you're not supposed to be tactful and discreet in a secret cable. Right. You're supposed to be candid and frank, right?
Indeed. And my point is that a lot of the preaching that goes on in democracies about openness and transparency, you know, targeting authoritarian regimes such as China, is all fine and good. But when we're having WikiLeaks exposing diplomats and their cables, there seems to be a hypocrisy here, because when you attack the messenger for trying to bring forth confidential cables and perhaps revealing unpleasant truth, I think that only is refreshing, and I think that is only positive for freedom of speech and democracy.
Ted, I appreciate your call. Let me take it. We've got the point loud and clear. Let me take it to Jack Beatty. Jack, are you refreshed this week? How are you looking out on the global situation now that there's so much more that's naked? As many have pointed out, a lot of what came out here we could kind of presume, but it's quite different to see the cables themselves saying, you know, Merkel's too cautious, Putin's a brute or whatever it said, you know, Saudi Arabia wants attacks on Iran, in black and white.
I can't believe that it's going to do any serious damage. I really can't. I mean, essentially, this is just the, you know, making apparent what we all know. It seems to me the effect will blow over. I am encouraged, frankly, by the candor and realism of some of these American diplomats, especially in taking the measure of our so-called allies in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, the cables from the former ambassador to Pakistan about the difficulty of getting Pakistan to even allow us to examine this disused nuclear material to which we have a right since we provided it to them, think of that, in the 60s under some benighted plan. And they won't even let us look at it. And there it is. And who knows what could happen to it. The cables today about the depth and the height in the government of corruption in that Afghan government.
They found this one clean minister. One out of all the ministers of government.
Put that guy in a bubble. It is at such a remove from the guff we have heard from the Obama administration about our allies, and we're working with them, and they're showing progress, and they help. And here's the, you know, that's the manifest content. Here's the real stuff. And I think you could take some of that and say to the Obama people, tell us the truth about these, quote, allies.
Jill, you know Moscow from your years there as a bureau chief. You know Afghanistan from a lot of work there. What do you see just on those two fronts out of the WikiLeaks revelations?
Well, it's, again, as we were saying, everybody basically knows this. I mean, every day we see Hamid Karzai, incompetent leader, incapable of ruling, corruption in Afghanistan.
Ambassador Eikenberry said so a year ago and more, not a good strategic
precisely.
Ally.
I mean, a lot of that has been out. But, you know, Tom, I have to go back to this point of let it all hang out. This is freedom of speech, and we all need to know this stuff. I don't think so. I do not agree with that. It's interesting, et cetera. But if you are going to conduct foreign policy for any government, not just the United States, you have to have the ability, number one, if you are in the field as a diplomat, to report back to your bosses honestly about what is going on. And I really do believe there, if you're going to have an effective foreign policy, you have to be able to have some of that in confidence. Because otherwise, there is no ability to influence the game worldwide. You cannot do what you want to do internationally by tipping your hand and saying, hey, I don't really mean this. I'm just saying it. Wink and a nod. It's crazy. You have to have that ability. So the people who say, let's talk about everything, I think are really naive about the world and how it functions.
Maybe, but the battle is on. And as you say, it may be that the naivete is now in the notion that you can have things secret. We will soon see. There's so much on the table this week. Deficit talk and tax talk, unemployment and those vanishing unemployment benefits. We've got lots of callers. Debbie in Billerica, Massachusetts. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm very concerned that although we have growing disparities between the very wealthy and the middle class and low-income people, and that the Simpson-Bowles proposal and a number of others are going to make these disparities, these inequities, worse, that needs to be discussed, and I'm not hearing it.
We will pick it straight up, Debbie, and I'm glad you raised it. We kind of need to get back to that. We've got so much here, but we'll come to unemployment. A lot of callers on that. But Jay Newton Small, look at this deficit plan. Now, the final vote out today, but nobody expecting the supermajority needed to require it to come up in front of Congress. But we've got a big change coming in Congress, and it's toward Republicans who are you know, backing the cutting of spending over everything else. I mean, you know, what do you see coming out of this week of high rhetoric here, lots of plans on the table, and now for some weeks, as we head into the post-midterm election Congress, Jay, are we headed for action here, just more talk? Does something really get done in this next year or not?
No, I mean, I think we're looking at a giant recipe for logjam here. It's just it's really hard to see how much gets through Congress in the next year or two. There's just so much partisan rancor, and there is this sort of irony of voters wanting change, and so voting for people who are promising the change, the one who has the most vocal voice for change, but then in doing so, voting for the most hyper-partisan people. And Congress has just been increasingly polarized, and it's just, you know, it's very hard to imagine anything coming out of the Senate. The House is obviously going to be doing its own thing because they have, once you have control of the House, you can pass pretty much whatever you like. Mm-hmm. But whether that there's very little of that legislation will actually pass the Senate. And so they're really just going to be totally jammed. And I don't know that anything from the Deficit Commission will get through, particularly because Republicans have this sort of conundrum where they like a lot of the cuts proposed by the Deficit Commission, but they don't like the tax increases. And then there's sort of, you know, how do you pay for it? How do you balance the budget if you make cuts, but then also don't help off, you know, help the sort of other side of the equation by increasing taxes? And we've now gone through two wars where, you know, historically in wartime, we've raised taxes. We've gone through two wars where we've actually lowered taxes, which has essentially helped to create this deficit situation that we've got going on here. So it's a real conundrum for Republicans because they don't know what to do with the tax side of it. They're clearly for cutting more taxes. And yet, you know, the spending cuts the Democrats won't agree to those unless there's also some pain on the other side.
Jack Beatty, we heard just yesterday here from a Bush-era economic advisor. I didn't hear any backing down in her assessment of what's going on, but things are changing here. You hear our listener, Debbie, and she says what she sees in Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson's plans is a recipe for exacerbation of the growing inequality we've seen in this country, Jack, by putting everything on spending, not so much on more revenues, potentially more revenues from the rich.
Yes, I mean, it's a 3-to-1 ratio, cuts in spending to increases in taxes. That's too much, or at least you'd think that the Democrats would be saying that. Now, I mentioned, I think, a very significant moment here for the president coming up. And I think Dick Durbin, his close friend from Illinois, signals what that's going to be. Durbin has signed on to this program. He's perhaps the most progressive member of the commission. And he's done it with, as I said, he says it has to have some stimulus next year, and then we'll get serious in 2013 about the cuts. So stimulus of tax cuts, and he also wants some infrastructure spending, just what the Obama administration wants. I think that's what we're going to hear from the president, I suspect, in the State of the Union. And the president has got to be thinking about 2012 and in respect especially of the deficit. You know, Michael Bloomberg, if there is ever an issue that would be teed up for him to run for president, it would be you're not acting on this deficit. You're not acting on the debt. I will. And the president, I think, has got to be mindful that, he could face a substantial challenge from that quarter, self-financed billionaire.
Yep.
And there have been rumblings about that. Unless he shows seriousness, even if it means taking on Democratic constituencies about Social Security age and cutting spending and so on, I think he's got to, you know, he's really got to have that political reality squarely in his eyes. And I think the Durbin coming out from this really signals where the president will end up in the State of the Union.
One more call just before the break. Stan in Urbandale, Iowa. Stan, our time is short, so give it to us fast and sweet.
Okay. I hope they fail.
And who? What?
What I'm referring to is the current debate on the unemployment benefits and the tax rate adjustments. What they're showing in Congress, what I see, is just the same dysfunctional. You know, they didn't learn from the election that.
Do you have a job, Stan? Do you have a job?
No, I don't.
Do you need unemployment benefits?
I could use them. That's for sure. But But I just, what I see, this debate right now.
Stan, that's all we're going to get. We're up against the clock here, but I appreciate your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at a big week in the news. This is On Point. Sorry, Stan. Jill, Jay, Jack, we'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, NBA star LeBron James played before his old fans in Cleveland, who were still not happy about his defection to Miami.
And I have nothing bad to say about these fans at all. You know, seven great years.
But the boos went on. The United States will not host the 2022 World Cup soccer games. They will be in the Persian Gulf.
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
And Grammy nominations spinning out with rapper Eminem back with the Big Ten, including for Love the Way You Lie with Rihanna.
I laid hands on him. I never stooped so low again. I guess I don't know my own strength.
Just gonna stand there and watch me burn. But that's all right because I like the way it hurts.
Looking at a week in the news, a lot of people not singing this week. WikiLeaks revelations, debt, taxes, unemployment benefits running out. Jill Doherty is with us from CNN, their foreign affairs correspondent. J. Newton Small, who covers Congress for Time Magazine. Jack Beatty's here. Fred in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Fred.
Hi, Tom. Just in the interest of protecting my beloved NPR from charges of bias,
once in a while,
instead of referring to them as tax cuts for the rich, alternately refer to them as tax incentives for productive employers and investors. The rich are not the enemy. The lack of jobs is.
I'm all for that, and yet we haven't had enough investment going on right now. And surely, Fred, I mean, we have seen incredible concentration of wealth in this country sort of beyond where we'd seen it for a long, long time. I mean, the rich is also quite an accurate tag, is it not?
Tom, that's just the Democratic argument. The Republican argument, which you need to balance it with, is that rich people should be encouraged to employ more and invest more, and they will do so if they continue to get tax cuts.
Fred, we're all for employment and we're all for investment, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here from Orlando, Florida. David, you're on the air.
I'm just disgusted with this $3 trillion bailout over and above TARP, to foreign banks, Caterpillar, General Electric, and we're quivering over $56 billion they could take from somewhere within the existing budget for the unemployed. I just can't believe that's not a headline. It's like a footnote in the New York Times.
You're talking about the revelations this week. The Fed was required by law to say exactly how much it has spent in the whole bailout era and on whom, I guess, David.
Yes. Wasn't that just a shocking revelation? I mean, Caterpillar, General Electric are getting a bailout? I mean, these guys are fabulously wealthy. They've worked very hard at shipping jobs overseas, and yet the same people that are bailing them out are now getting told, well, no, we're the principle. We're going to stand on principle. It's not just the Democrats, Republicans. It's everybody in Washington. It's just amazing. I know we've bailed out some people with two or three homes on the Hamptons, and yet there's nothing for these people. Nothing. $56 billion is nothing compared to $3 trillion.
David, I appreciate your call. J. Newton Small, that was kind of an eye-popping report from the Fed this week, required by congressional action to say exactly where their support has gone since the meltdown. And yes, there were a lot of very big corporations in there. Productive investors and employers, perhaps, as our caller Fred says, but Dave doesn't like the looks of all the bailout money up against what unemployment benefits would take here.
Well, I mean, the Fed is, keep in mind, the Fed is separate from Congress, and so
though Congress is all over it in recent days, and what, Rand Paul wants to end it.
Yeah, Rand Paul's always been trying to end it for years. He's been trying to end it, Ron, too, his dad. But I mean, look, the Fed functions under very different rules and very different circumstances than, say, the TARP money that Congress passed, which was much more closely regulated, or even the money that Treasury would give out. And there's not that much that Congress can do to change the way the Fed works. And in fact, the Fed, I think the reason the story wasn't a much bigger story is that all of that money was actually repaid by the foreign banks, by the corporations. So I think if you'd seen them get this bailout then not be able to pay them back, it would have been a bigger deal, but they all paid it back. So
Jack, here's a comment online from Gregor. It says, Tom, please don't neglect the biggest news story of the week. Obama, by failing to fight for the middle class, has begun to dig his own political grave for 2012. And you're starting to point at that, perhaps, Jack, before the break. Led by the president, the Dems have proven themselves to be spineless beyond belief. I'm utterly disgusted, disenchanted, caving in on the super-rich tax cuts. Sorry, Fred, in Cambridge, is the final last straw. I mean, there is a lot of spotlight here this week, Jack, on who's standing exactly where and big choices for the president on how to play his weakened hand.
A very much weakened hand. And in that vein, we have Paul Krugman today. He says, it almost seems as if Mr. Obama is trying to disappoint his once fervent supporters to convince the people who put him where he is that they made an embarrassing mistake. And he's alluding to the president's continual misrepresentation of reality. You know, if you read his book, The Audacity of Hope, he talks a lot about bipartisanship. And he says, that's really what Americans want. And he uses the model of Illinois. He said, you know, in Illinois, I didn't have a lot in common with people from downstate, but we worked together. We got things done. It really echoes what President Bush said in his autobiography years ago about Texas. I worked with the Democrats. We got things done. Well, Bush in Texas didn't have national liberals to deal with. Obama in Illinois didn't have national conservatives to deal with. There is no middle ground. And he keeps pretending that there is some bipartisan spirit that he's willing to kindle. And it lasts, for an hour or half a day. And then Mitch McConnell will say, we're shutting the place down unless we get what we want. And, you know, why is the president doing that? Why is he pretending that there is a spirit to work together between these parties when it's plainly not the case? It's as if he's trying to reach out to that independent voter who wants this bipartisanship, but merely talking about it won't do it. It makes him seem out of touch, and it weakens him with his own most fervent supporters.
Jay, how do you read the politics of that, or maybe the Obama instinct of that?
Well, I think that you have this base that is incredibly disappointed by, you know, the last 2 years where they didn't get anything done on climate change. They didn't pass the Employee Free Choice Act or do things for unions that they'd promised to do. They got a health care plan that didn't have a strong public plan in it. They didn't pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They haven't done anything on the DREAM Act or immigration. And so this base is really angry that the Democrats squandered what they saw as the largest mandate in a generation and didn't do any of the things that they had promised that they would do. And now you've got this situation where they're clamoring for Obama to step it up and really, you know, take a hard line on taxes, you know, play chicken with Republicans on things like unemployment benefits, challenge, make them filibuster in the Senate. And Obama, meanwhile, knows that he can't get anything done and desperately needs to get things done unless he compromises, which essentially just makes his base even more unhappy because they already feel like he's the compromiser in chief. So he's in a bit of a bind right now. He needs to get stuff done. He needs to compromise, but they don't want him to.
Yeah, and there we are. Don't Ask, Don't Tell on the table this week, speaking of things where there maybe will be a compromise. Pentagon wanting something done here. You've got Defense Secretary Robert Gates telling Congress that if they don't act, and he's encouraging them to act in the lame duck session, that the courts may do it to force the Pentagon to do something very quickly. Here he is speaking on Tuesday, emphasizing that service personnel from the latest survey done by the Pentagon we heard about this week would not be negatively affected by such change in policy.
In my view, the concerns of combat troops as expressed in the survey do not present an insurmountable barrier to successful repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This can be done and should be done without posing a serious risk to military readiness. However, these findings do lead me to conclude that an abundance of care and preparation is required if we are to avoid a disruptive and potentially dangerous impact on the performance of those serving at the tip of the spear in America's wars.
Jay, the Pentagon survey finding 70% of those surveyed, 115,000 or so, thought that, you know, they were okay or at least mixed on ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, allowing open gay service in the military. What are you hearing in Congress? Do you see a chance of a vote on that after Secretary Gates' plea there this week in the lame duck session or not?
Well, first they have to finish Member Mitch McConnell's letter to the administration saying we're not going to let anything
extend
through
all the tax
they,
cuts or.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So they have to finish tax cuts and the continuing resolution. But once that's done, yes, the plan is to pick up the defense reauthorization bill in which Don't Ask, Don't Tell already is already in there. Now, but you still have a bunch of Republicans who are very much against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, despite what, you know, Secretary Gates is saying. You've got John McCain, Lindsey Graham, who are adamant that this will not go, will not pass. And the question is, do Democrats have 60 votes in order to see it done?
And so far, not there. On other fronts this week, we had a bunch of former Republican secretaries of state calling on Washington to move ahead, calling on Congress to move ahead with the new START treaty that has been also stalled behind this tax cut block. Colin Powell was at the White House on Wednesday saying we've got to do this, standing with President Obama. Here's former Secretary of State Colin Powell.
The world has benefited by having fewer of these horrible weapons in existence, and we hope that we can continue this process. New START is important because it continues this process, and it's especially important because at the end of last year, we lost the verification system that we had under START 1. And this is the first time in all these years where we don't have these procedures in place. So we're not sure exactly what's going on within the Russian Federation. They're not exactly sure what's going on in the United States of America.
Jill Doherty, Congress, Republicans, not eager to move on this. They want to hold it until they're in the majority in at least one House. What about the consequences of this? And what do you make of so many former Republican secretaries of state coming out and saying we need to do something here?
Well, they're taking the long-term look at this and saying, actually, it's not such a big deal. New START is not a gigantic treaty. It's actually very short. It's a follow-on treaty. And it leads to other things that deal with other types of weapons. But this has become a big deal because of the election, you know, the midterm elections. And it's something that can be held up. And if it's held up until the next term, then it could have more trouble getting through because, of course, the Democrats won't have as many people. And, you know, it gets caught into so many different views about does the United States have enough money for modernization of the nuclear forces? And the Obama administration coughed up more money for that. It's tied into that debate about missile defense, even though it's really not directly connected. So implications would be, you know, if it doesn't pass here, it's not going to pass and be ratified in the Russian parliament either. And it could, at least most observers say, have a bad effect on the relationship between both countries.
Colin Powell saying it leaves everybody blind to what's going on with nuclear weapons. Speaking, Jack, of old agreements and new challenges, you've been still keeping an eye on Korea this week.
Yes, and just today we read in the New York Times that their new defense minister has come out and said, if the enemy attacks our people and territory, I will use force to punish the enemy to make sure he doesn't even dare think of doing
it
again.
Is that South Korea's new defense?
This is South Korea's.
That sounds like North Korean talk.
Yeah, I know, exactly, a four-star general. But think of that. A South Korean general could reopen the Korean War. I mean, suppose something does happen, the South does strike the North, and we are linked, we are entrapped in that alliance. Our forces there are a, quote, tripwire, meaning the wire that's tripped is that to a full-scale war on the Korean Peninsula, which could happen at any time. You know, this Korea, this froze in 1953, and nothing has changed in our policy in all that time. And, you know, it's China's sphere of influence. Imagine if you're playing out scenarios that could get us into a big war with China, that would, along with Taiwan, would be one of the top, that we would essentially have a replay of the Korean War with South Korean and no doubt U.S. forces pushing north toward the Yalu River. What would the Chinese do? We don't belong there. And, you know, the idea that, you know, if we're not there, somehow the North will march in. You know, from time immemorial, nations have bandwagoned with aggressors who threatened them. They could ally with China, or they have balanced against them. They had worked it out themselves. The idea that the superpower, which is no longer a superpower, needs to stay there and put our people at risk to South Korean posturing generals, boy, I tell you, it is a dangerous situation, and the State Department, the thinking in our foreign policy establishment never looks at it.
But, Jill, I mean, if the United States would start to pull out of agreements like that, what would that mean? Is that possible? What would that mean for the balance of power in this world, in this region?
It's extremely delicate right now, and I think it is correct that the United States is caught in the middle, because you have the rhetoric, unbelievable rhetoric, and actions from the North that are very dangerous. Then you have a pretty conservative South Korean government, which ended the sunshine policy with the North just a few weeks back, and they are upping the rhetoric. You know, that's a country where both countries are still Koreans, and it is a place where emotions can run high. It's a very, very dangerous situation. And then you have China. But I think, you know, interestingly, WikiLeaks show that China, according to the South Koreans, might be okay if, let's say, Kim Jong-il dies, the regime falls, and a united country is created under what essentially would be South Korea, that they might be okay with that. So there are a lot of implications to this. You know, Tom, I just wanted to say one thing connecting foreign policy and the domestic policy, which is, as we're talking about what's going on in Capitol Hill, you know, there are some people internationally who look at the United States right now and say, here is the superpower, and it is incapable of solving its internal domestic issues, which are very serious, you know, budgets, deficits, anything like that. And there is a feeling that you get from some people who really look at this seriously, that people are, you know, fiddling while Rome burns, that if this superpower doesn't get its act together and solve some of its internal problems, there are going to be problems internationally.
Doesn't look like a very firm status quo at the moment. And news out in this hour that the Obama Deficit Commission has indeed failed to win enough votes to advance the whole program to Congress. So that, big noise, and now maybe changing attitudes, but not formally going anywhere. Grateful to each of you for being with us in this hour. Jill Doherty with CNN, foreign affairs correspondent there, joining us from Washington. Jill, thank you very much for your time and insights today.
You're welcome.
Jay Newton Small, congressional correspondent for Time Magazine. Wonderful to have you, Jay. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.